On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. My name is Nicole Henderson. I'm your moderator today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm going to cover a few points to help you understand how to actively participate in today's training. First up, I'd like to note that we do have two poll questions open here on the slide if you're able to provide some information to us at the beginning. Thank you. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on slide 2, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. The guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2019. We're not going to cover all the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document today, so please take a look at the website if you have not already done so. You can find the link to the ITRC document in the related links box here on the right-hand side of your screen. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping rules. Hopefully many of you have joined us from previous ITRC and CLUIN events and are familiar with these, but we'll run through them quickly for our new participants. We have started the seminar with all phone lines muted to prevent background noise. Please keep your phone lines muted during the training to minimize disruption and background. During the question and answer break, press #6 to unmute your line to ask a question. *6 will mute your phone again. Please also do not put this call on hold, as this may bring unwanted background music over the lines and interrupt the training class. Use the Q&A box in the lower right-hand corner to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems anytime. For questions and comments provided out loud, please hold until the designated Q&A break. That will be about halfway through the training course and at the end. We also ask that everyone please complete the feedback form before you leave the training website. The link to the feedback form is available on the last slide and also in the related links box on your right-hand side of your screen. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the State. It's a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Members participate in technical teams throughout the year to produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating in today. If you'd like to learn more about ITRC or become a member, please visit the ITRC website or feel free to contact us directly. On the website, you will see where you can register for the technical teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review the usage policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers for today. All of them have been active members of the ITRC's Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance Team. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. Thank you to you guys for participating today. Our trainers today are listed here on the slide. I'm so happy they're able to join us for this first course offering. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page. You can also access it in that related links box by clicking on CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse to. At the bottom of the training page, you can access their bios. All right, let's move on to slide number 6, and I am passing it off to Chris.
Thank you, Nicole, and thank you all for attending this webinar. Wow, over 500. That's awesome. That's awesome. Could you please open the poll question, Nicole? Have you ever had a remedy not meet design expectations? All right, I'm going to give you a few minutes to look at that. But this first slide gives you the web address for our document that we put together over the past 2 years. And as with most of the ITRC documents in the recent years, they are web-based. There's no finding them in paper, at least as of yet. But the web allows us to cross-link and get away from the standard paper sizes of 8.5 by 11 or 11 by 17. So this is just a, as you'll find from this webinar today, we have just that the web is terrific for, like I said, cross-linking and et cetera. So let's keep that poll question going. I want to tell you that you are in the right spot for the next 2 hours if you said yes to the poll question. If you said no, there are a handful of us that contributed to this document that would like to know your secret. And it looks like only 6 of you have said no. So thank you very much, Nicole. You can close that now. As our first slide implies, this webinar is aimed at your site involving injection of amendments at the correct doses for the in situ remediation of contaminant mass and how to optimize any phase of that process. Although this subject of in situ remediation is far from new, it's been around for at least 30 years, and making great progress with each advancing year, everyone, even the ones who said no to the poll question, have encountered challenges when it comes to in situ remediation. Okay, the problem we are facing going into this document is failing to achieve expected performances of in situ injection remedies and encountering unknown variables that impact effectiveness. Our team did a survey of state regulators across the U.S. for remediation proposals that they received, and 40% deemed the first submittal as incomplete. Why? Well, interestingly enough, it hinged around an incomplete conceptual site model, which in turn led, for example, to inadequate amendment placement or choosing the wrong delivery for the site geology. So, what is optimization? Well, according to ITRC's 2016 Geospatial Analysis for Optimization, it is the effort at any cleanup phase to identify and implement actions that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency of that phase. Optimizing in situ remediation is the management of risks and uncertainties through sound science and engineering during different stages of in situ remedy planning and implementation. I emphasize these words because they are the theme of this course and of this document. I hope you can see this webinar and the accompanying guidance document intend to promote best practices for the benefit of all attending this webinar, the regulatory agencies, the responsible parties, the consultants, and the public. I want you to think of this document, this web-based document, and its tables and its fact sheets as an optimization toolbox. On the left, we are giving you the first introduction to the layout of this guidance. And on the right are the tools that we're going to use to optimize the remedial process. We want to make it clear that we wrote this document for remediation managers, responsible parties, and regulators. Perhaps you're having partial success, but progress has stalled out. Perhaps you've pushed the contaminant mass towards a sensitive receptor. Uh-oh, what did I do wrong? Perhaps you've written a good CSM, feel pretty confident about your remedy selection, but you just want to make sure there are no data gaps and that your amendments will work with the selected delivery method. We also wrote this for state regulators to identify potential shortcomings in the remediation plans and to ask specific questions of the consultants and the responsible parties. Now, caveat here, we did not write this document as a remediation 101. You need to be familiar with the principles of in situ remediation and the preparation of a CSM. So where do we start? What are the technical challenges? What are the challenges you are encountering with an existing remedy and its implementation? I just listed a couple that might be happening at your site. Let's throw out a few more scenarios and see if this might be happening. Are we having higher concentrations after injections compared to baseline? Or is there no indication of change after an amendment injection? Do you have insufficient amendment distribution and contact at your site? Or is your amendment daylighting? Or further, are you using the vendor's default dosing zone, the values, instead of data from your CSM? With these challenges in mind, let's head to Table 1-1 in Appendix B of the guidance. This slide is a snapshot of the commonly encountered issues associated with remedial design characterization. There are two other sections from this table called Commonly Encountered Issues with Amendment Dose and Delivery and Commonly Encountered Issues with Field Implementation. Now, please don't try to read the gray print, but please do pay attention to the column headings. As you identify your lithology and your contaminant, which is the two left columns, then read the third column, which is common challenges, lessons learned, and best practices. And then the fourth column is the real key. The fourth column contains links to, within the context, within the content of the text, with links to particular delivery or amendment fact sheets, or to other ITRC-related documents, as you see here in blue. The links are will take you directly to those fact sheets or the other ITRC documents. If there's anything I can tell you as the introductory speaker here, it is to say, I want you to be able to take this table as your customized table of contents, tailored to your particular site conditions or the challenges you are facing. Consider this your table of contents. All right, so the learning objectives today and what we're talking about right now is identifying the challenges, apply iterative optimization process at each stage, determine the amendment dose and delivery, monitor the performance to make optimization decisions, and anticipate iterative refinement. Let's pay attention to that word iterative because it's going to come up again. Very importantly, and to demonstrate the learning objectives, I give you the presentation roadmap that we're going to go through today. This is exciting because, as you just heard me say, this is the way that our guidance document is laid out. And importantly, this slide shows you the our key graphic, which is on the left, the two hexagons with the design wheel in the middle. If you consider the top and bottom boxes as the bread of a sandwich, the lettuce, tomato, and meat are the three that correlate to the order the document is written in. So as the way today is mapped and presented, Rich DeRozier will talk about remedial design characterization. Then Suzanne O'Hare will talk about the design of amendment dose and delivery. Elizabeth Ryan will talk about implementation, monitoring, and interpretation through a couple of case studies. And then I will wrap up and talk about regulatory and stakeholder considerations. All right. Hopefully this chart is familiar to you because it is the CERCLA process of remediating sites and taking them to closure, which is also similar to the RCRA process for petroleum-impacted sites. But the common goal of both is to clean up sites, right? As we developed this guidance document, we realized the linear approach to the left gave us no flexibility. And so, as I presented to you in the last slide, our key graphic was born. By now, you've gotten a good hint of our three main elements of our document, the remedial design characterization in the red hexagon, the design wheel with amendment dose and delivery, and the implementation monitoring and interpretation hexagon. Can you see the difference simply in the arrows connecting both diagrams, left and right? The left has linear arrows going in one direction. we discovered that optimization was the outcome of better characterizing our subsurface conditions, improving the CSM, performing bench tests and pilot studies, making mistakes, and then going back to an earlier step, i.e. the double-headed arrows on the right. We realized the most flexible approach had to be iterative. Now, we are not throwing away the graphic on the left. We are simply taking our, hang on, hold on a sec, I'm trying to get this arrow, there we go. We are simply taking our design and our key graphic, and we're substituting it for these two steps in the CERCLA process, which allows for the optimization. There's the optimization. And guess what? The iterative approach is not new. Our key graphic is an augmentation of ITRC's 2011 Integrated Dean Apple Site Strategy Guidance on the left. Do you see how it fits into the treatment technology portion and the monitoring? So this is a figure that's within our guidance document. The true nature of in-situ remediation is iterative. The iterative and interactive approach lets the CSM become adaptable to new technologies and new contaminants. The team further augmented the key graphic with what we call the optimization staircase to the right of the key graphic, wherein the process of implementing, monitoring, and optimization take place during bench test and pilot studies in the blue and in the tan, and then during the full-scale implementation in the blue hexagon. Do you see the opportunities for optimization wherein the feedback loops of the optimization staircase take you back to the miniature design wheels, you know, if necessary, of monitoring and implementation did not work. So by optimizing, you're saying you're going back and say, we got to figure something else out here. The contact wasn't made, the amendments weren't correct. This allows you to go back to the design. So with that, I'm going to pass this now to Rich DeRozier, who is with GZA Geoenvironmental, and he's going to discuss remedial design characterization. Rich?
Thanks, Chris. Excellent setup. I want to welcome everybody to today's presentation, and the topic I'll be discussing will be the remedial design characterization. The initial poll indicated that 98% online indicated that the remedy didn't meet the expectations of the design. So one of those issues that Chris had talked about was the red section or the remedial design characterization. We've all gone out and we've done our phase two and our phase three to define the nature and extent of contamination. Today we'd want to talk about a little bit more in terms of those design aspects for a remedy or what's necessary. So really, what is remedial design characterization? We've all done this a little bit on each one of our projects, but we're trying to consolidate it here in this ITRC document. It is really the collection of additional data above and beyond the general site characterization necessary to develop a sufficient detailed site conceptual model. Now, most of the time we go out, we have our site conceptual model for the site where we have put in monitoring wells, and we've delineated the nature and extent of the contamination. However, in this particular application, where we're trying to optimize that information, we want to perhaps recommend that additional design characterization is necessary in order to be successful when we design a system. So today's discussion is really going to look in terms of how the design information is a basis for a successful in-situ remedy. And so you ask, why do we want to do additional characterization? We've already characterized the site, and we feel we've done a good job. We get 98% of you at the beginning and the onset of this presentation indicated that the remedy didn't meet the design. So maybe there's some additional information that is necessary to further the optimization outcome. And we believe through this document, and as you'll see how it's put together, there is often a lack of detailed data or insufficient to develop a real conceptual site model for remediation. And therefore, the success of the in-situ remediation is really directly related to a thorough understanding of the site subsurface conditions. And from that standpoint, we have sort of a couple of graphics that we're going to go through. And recently, there's been some documents out in terms of stratification sequencing, where once you start looking at your subsurface conditions, you need to connect not only the geology, the geochemistry together in terms of how these components are going to affect your remedial design. So in this example, we have a series of monitoring wells that were installed over 3,500 feet on this section, and the borings were logged every 5 feet in an alluvial formation. And as you can see here, there appears to be some stratigraphic units. The gray is low permeable units. The lighter green is more permeable or medium permeable units. And the dark greens are the high permeable units. And you can see the blue line is showing where the approximate water table was observed. Under this scenario, we're looking at one boring every 500 feet. We add additional data, so now we're looking at 40 boreholes here over the same 3,500-foot alignment, and we're still logging our boreholes every 5 feet. Perhaps we're using hollow-stemmed augers with split spoons. Perhaps we're using geoprobes to collect the samples as we vertically profile the soils. So, again, we're finding that through a higher resolution, we're starting to see more complex subsurface conditions. We see that there's not just a linear relationship towards the bottom of the aquifer, but we see there are some additional stringers that we see that are more highly permeable within the low permeable unit. However, if we add additional borings in this particular application, there were 60 boreholes over the same 3,500-foot alignment. And in this case, the boreholes were continuously logged. Now, those loggings could be by vertical profiling, such as an MIP profile, where we can get high-resolution data every tenth of a foot. It could be that there was continuous soil samplings, perhaps through rhotosonic techniques or geoprobe sampling continuously. So there's a lot of different techniques that can be used to provide a higher level of geologic information. And as you can see, it's more evolved in terms of the lithology. There are discontinuous lenses of high permeable units among the lower permeable units in this particular section, whereas the first section we saw, there was lenses at the bottom in sort of a matrix of low permeable material around. So now you can see that the complexity of this particular section is going to lead to a different potential outcome. And you can also see the change in the groundwater environment through the blue lines, where in certain areas there may be perch conditions, other areas there are changes in the groundwater. And these are important to look at both not only the horizontal but also the vertical groundwater flow component. So what do we need in order to develop our RDC, or remedial design characterization? We just saw in the example before, geology is very important. Hydrogeology, equally as important to define the influence on groundwater flow and the transport regime in which the contaminant is going to move. Geochemistry, extremely important because we're injecting materials in the subsurface, so electron acceptors, or are they going to be competitors? Are we going to mobilize metals in the formation? So again, as we're trying to develop a successful remedy, geochemistry plays a very important role, as well as the microbiology. What are the degradation pathways in the environment itself? And the next sections we're going to talk about is how the importance of these things can be used in order to develop the remedial design characterization. Now, I know you're out there and you're saying, well, that means I'm going to have to go back to my client and ask for additional money. And they may not be as much in favor of additional characterization, but we've put together this drawing where we really think that there is a value for the additional investigation, or VOI, in figure 2.1 within the document. If you spend more money with additional characterization, and so you can see there's two lines. There's the red line, which shows without the additional characterization, leading to sometimes ineffective remedies, and perhaps having to go back out and to collect additional data. With the RDC, while there is a capital cost at the onset, you can see that by having a broader understanding of the stratigraphy and the hydrogeology and the geochemistry, you end up with a more effective remedy, shorter time frames, and therefore a significant cost reduction. So here is the value of the investigation on a case study basis. This was a study that was done on a 20-acre site in the Central Valley in California, impacted with volatile organics to both the soil and groundwater. And it's located within a floodplain deposits. The target treatment zone was really the sand lenses that were several feet thick and approximately 15 feet below grade. Now, in this particular application, the client was under a very tight redevelopment time frame, and the selection was enhanced in situ bioremediation using a sodium lactate. So let's see what happens when we use the existing data to try to develop a remedy. And what happened? The good news is the geology was very well characterized. However, the injections were properly performed within the sand intervals. So we ended up injecting within the target zones that we were shooting for. The bad news is that we did not have the hydraulic conductivity fully evaluated. The injection tests were not performed, so the radius of influence was not known. The geochemical parameters were not used to assess the viability of the solution. No treatability tests were done, and the choice of the substrate was based upon similar sites. Now, we all think we have a good handle based upon what we've done before and what might work, but nature throws a lot of things against us, and we really need to understand the site-specific information as we develop an in-situ remedy. There were no microbiological studies performed, and the upgradient source was not removed or fully assessed. So what was the outcome? This guy here shows the ugly outcome. There were no reductions in groundwater contamination, unfortunately, and the site redevelopment was delayed. So the site had to be recharacterized to develop better definitions of source areas, better plume delineation, additional hydraulic conductivity and radius of influences need to be completed, microbial testing was done, treatability studies to assess various substrates and specific dosing were also evaluated, and the gradient source was removed. So these were the lessons learned by using information that was readily available without gathering the information for site-specific reasons. And here's an example of the cost related to the outcome of the case study. And what we can see in this particular application is we have the initial characterization of 150,000. And we've got two columns. One was the initial study, and the second column, if we used a hypothetical RDC solution. So the hypothetical RDC solution was to spend an additional $160,000 worth of investigation. You can see here, this is what was the cost for the remedy, $380,000 for both the implementation and the monitoring, which was not a cost if we had done the high-resolution site characterization. The RDC, we had to redo it. So $160,000, we can see in the example, is also the same cost that had to be redone because of the failed solution. We also can see that at the end, the remedy and the monitoring would still be the same. So where do we end up with? We ended up with a reworked solution that saved between the two $380,000 by moving forward with the upfront RDC. But more importantly, you can see here that we have time frame. So we have two studies with the study that failed and the study using RDC. As you can see at the end, there's a 3-year net savings in terms of the time in order to meet the remedy. So here's a table that I don't expect anybody to read, but really the important takeaways are, is this is a table 2.2 within the document, and we've identified physical properties, flow properties, and aqueous geochemical properties, along with microbials and degradation pathways. So these are very important areas that we're going to get in individually. So the table itself, let's just go over it like Chris did a few minutes ago, in terms of the headers that become very important. Up on top, you can see that the parameters are in the far left. The next two columns are in the middle, the in situ approach. Are we dealing with abiotic or biotic degradation? That's really important, especially on sites where we might have, you know, cyst DCE, it's not going any further. We might see areas where we have vinyl chloride. So again, understanding the approach. The remediation phase and steps are the last three columns where we have alternative screening, remedial design, and performance monitoring. And then we've provided some color codes in there and some lettering. And the lettering is really whether or not it's more applicable or less applicable. And the color codes are really the salmon color, which are low importance, the median being yellow, and the high being green. So let's look at each of these independently. So here's the physical property. So now you can see a little bit more information. But again, we have a whole bunch of names and parameters on the left-hand side. What we've done is we've really taken a look at these, and because this is an interactive web-based document, we can take the provenance and mineralogies and hover over it. And so each of these parameters that you see have a discussion that you can just hover over the row, and you get some information regarding provenance and mineralogy. So you can sort of see why it's important that you may want to move forward with this. Another area might be stratigraphy. And in the example that we've shown before, where we had lenses at the bottom, but with more resolution, we saw that there was a lot of discontinuous formations. So again, stratigraphy is important. And again, if you want to have information regarding definitions, they're all as a hover table over each of these parameters. The same thing with the flow parameters. So again, we can look at heterogeneity. And again, heterogeneity is one of those very, very important aspects. I once had a site over on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where we were told that we had a homogeneous isotropic aquifer that was 270 feet deep. And I said, boy, I'd really like to see that, but for myself, I'd like to drill a hole. So we drilled a hole and we did some downhole geophysical, and we found that there were 28 unique stratigraphic units, and there was one clay unit which divided the whole sequence in the area, and we hadn't get that information for the final remedy. So heterogeneity becomes very important within the formation itself. Flow properties, again, and isotropy, again, another important aspects as you're looking at how groundwater is going to flow through the subsurface environment. Aqueous geochemistry, again, here is sulfate has been highlighted. And the reason for that is sulfate is one of those parameters that is naturally present. And can, or it can also be present from manufacturing processes, agricultural byproducts from persulfate, from a persulfate injection that might have been done. So sulfate could inhibit the reduction of the dechlorination process, or it can react with iron to form iron sulfates, providing a long-term anaerobic chemical reduction. So again, an important parameter to better understand. And here you can see where the sulfate is on the redox ladder as you're going down in terms of reducing environment and looking at different parameters that you may want to look at from a geochemical standpoint. Aqueous geochemistry, again, we have a poll question. Could you please bring that up? And as you take a few minutes to look, in your experience, can chloride concentrations be effectively used as a line of evidence of reductive dechlorination? So as you're answering that, we can look at, you know, different aspects of geochemical parameters. So we'll just give you another second on that. And again, this particular table is going to be very similar to the others, where each of the parameters has a definition. Once hovered over it, you'll be able to get additional information. So it looks like 67-68% of you say yes, and 32% say no. So if we could close this poll for now, we'll move on and look at chloride as another aspect. And again, you know, chloride can be present naturally in the formation, or it can be from another source present into the environment. And again, it can be difficult to detect or attribute solely to remediation of chlorinated solvents, especially in high chloride environments. So again, you get information as you're proceeding through this. Microbial reductions, again, very similar aspects in terms of how this is developed. As you can see here, dissolved hydrocarbons are very important, and the dissolved hydrocarbons themselves are a way in order to evaluate the effectiveness, perhaps, of a remedial concept. The presence of these dissolved gases can indicate that some complete reductive dechlorination is occurring. Take methane, where you can see that you might have methanogenesis going on from the reductive of carbon dioxide, indicating that you're in a significant reducing environment. So again, looking at different gases is one way in order to evaluate your data. And with that, I'd like to throw this back over to Nicole for some questions and answers, period. Thank you for your time.
Rich, thanks so much. Appreciate it. All right, here on slide 42, it's time for our question and answers portion of the training. I will give those on the phone line a moment here and to see if there's any questions. But as a reminder for those listening on through the computer, you can put your question into the Q&A pod, and we will read those and respond to them as we can. We'll work through as many as we can, and then after the Q&A break, our trainers will continue to respond to questions as needed. I do want to take a moment while people are putting some questions into the pod. If you're interested in receiving certificates of completion, that is available upon the completion of the presentation and the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. Also, ITRC archives all its training classes. So if you find that you have additional time or looking for additional training opportunities, please visit CLUIN and the archive trainings to see if there are other courses that might interest you. All right, so while we continue to remind people, please use the Q&A pod to ask your questions. But we're going to go to the phone lines first. And anybody on the phone line that would like to ask a question, it is #6 to unmute your line. Going to give everybody 1 minute. Okay, well, let's take some questions here from the Q&A pod. Trainers, how important is the bioavailability test for a remediation project? remind the trainers #6 if anybody's able to take that question.
Could you repeat the question?
Absolutely. How important is the bioavailability test for a remediation project?
Well, I think if you're looking at any kind of bioremediation, the bioavailability is really critical to understand what type of substrate that you may want to inject, and using a bench or treatability study to be able to evaluate a specific substrate's performance.
Great, thank you. How about for a $200,000 injection remedy, would it still be justified to conduct a pilot study or geotechnical sampling?
Well, I think, again, if you're looking at a $200,000 injection remedy, the assumption is it's only going to be $200,000. If we look at the example that we provided, it is possible that the remedy selected may not work and you need to go back in and gather additional information. You may want to evaluate as you're going through on your phase two and phase three on a small project and collect additional delineation. It's not very difficult to, during a subsurface investigation, to collect additional delineation for both soil for lithology. There's a lot of field kits that I know I've used during a hexachromium study where you can actually grab soils as you're drilling and try to do an analysis to determine the presence or absence of hexachrome. You have tools such as PIDs. So you can gather a lot of information in terms of your initial site characterization. And if you feel that the justification of that data is sufficient, then you could move forward, but I would always advise that a pilot study is a very valuable tool in order to understand how the injected material is going to basically react within the subsurface. In other words, what is the effective radius of influence? We know due to anisotropy, it's not circular, as a lot of people draw out, you know, circles to overlapping circles. They're more ellipses. We have to look in terms of what is the effective radius of influence to make the determination from the pilot in terms of how closely spaced do we need to put our injection points.
Rich, thanks so much for that. Another question here. Where did the data for the VOI graph come from? How many sites were used?
I'm going to have to pass on that one. I know that was our colleague, Suzanne, who put together the cross-section in terms of the number of data points. It's really an example in order to show that through a higher level of resolution, you can really expand your understanding of the subsurface and, you know, basically the subsurface conditions, so that when you do your injections, you're strategically targeting that target zone that you're looking for.
Great, thank you. Let's see, have a bunch coming in here. So thanks everybody for your questions. Additional data will improve the CSM. Would that result in change to the specific target level?
I think if you look at your conceptual site model and look at your changes that might occur, with the additional data, you might find that the geochemistry data might lend itself to varying very high concentrations in stringers in the subsurface conditions. Therefore, the total amount of mass present might change the stoichiometric calculations used in order to select your substrate or the volume of substrate that you might inject. So I think what's really important is throughout this whole process, you understand how the contaminant is migrating and really what the strength of the contaminant is, so that when you inject the material into the subsurface, it's going to be very effective.
We're going to take one more here, but I will remind folks that you can continue to utilize the Q&A pod throughout the presentation as you think of your questions, and we'll get to as many as we can. Trying to see which one to do. Sorry about that. Can you expand on how anisotropy, sorry if I butchered that word, can influence injection success?
I guess I'll take that one as well. Anisotropy becomes a very important aspect in terms of an injected material. We could find that, you know, perhaps the injected material may flow on an axis of X and Y, and in some cases the X being much greater than the Y. So again, your spacing of your injection points is going to be important based upon the anisotropy. And we may also be looking at knowing that the horizontal would be greater than the vertical, but in some aspects we may find that, you know, we need to change in terms of how the injection is being performed. Whether it's, you know, from a bottom up or top down or being recirculated in the formation. Anisotropy plays a very important role in terms of the success of in placing the injected material into the formation.
Great. We kept Rich busy during that Q&A. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to the second portion of the training. I'm going to move it to the next slide here, 43, and pass it on to Suzanne. Just a reminder, pound six to unmute.
Hi, sorry about that. I'm going to be talking about section three of our guidance document and start by thanking Chris and Rich for setting this up and for our audience for some great questions, some of which maybe we'll be touching on in some of the subsequent sections of this presentation, but we'll continue to try and answer these questions as we go as well in that Q&A box. So section three of the guidance document is the design portion of the document and looking at amendment, dose, and delivery. And I'm going to try and touch on some of the key topics covered in this section of the document. So the design involves a consideration of the proposed amendments, delivery method, and dose, and it applied simultaneously throughout your design, as well as the implementation and monitoring processes. Any step in that sequence can be repeated as new information becomes available. So we have our design wheel in our graphic here, and as Chris mentioned, that this is sort of one of our key graphics that is carried throughout the guidance document. And so the design wheel is the dose, delivery, and amendment, and you're considering all three of these during your design, and it's intended to be an iterative process. You can refine your design following the selection of your amendment and your delivery strategy by doing various tests, maybe bench sale tests and pilot tests as we've shown here. And what we've tried to set up is what we're calling the optimization staircase. So if you're going to do a bench test, you're starting with a smaller design wheel. You're considering the dose, delivery, and amendment in your bench scale test. You're going to do implementation of that test, monitor that test, and then optimize that test maybe by going back up and doing it again. Or if you've gotten the information that you want from your bench scale test, you might be then stepping through to your pilot test, which again would start with a design wheel and taking the information you're getting from that to implement your pilot test, monitor your pilot test, and then optimize your pilot test if you need to and go back up. You can even go back up to the bench scale test depending on what it is you see in your pilot test. but the key thing we're trying to get here is that the results of each one of these tests feeds back into the refinement of the subsequent test or the next phase of your design. So it is a cyclical nature, and that's why we're calling it the design wheel. So the first step in your design is defining your target treatment zone. So this is also often an iterative process. You have to take into consideration things like collateral effects, what kind of performance objectives you have, what are the costs of your remedy going to be. And that target treatment zone actually may be revised as your design is developed. Some of the key considerations that need to be taken into that you need to think about when you're defining your target treatment zone are things like your cleanup objectives. So you may have objectives of reducing your source area mass. You may be trying to protect a particular receptor or meeting an interim remedial goal or actually achieving site closure, which I think is maybe the objective for all of these at some scale. Or you may have other site-specific objectives. So you need to understand what those are in order to set your target treatment zone. You also need to take into effect the spatial and temporal relationships of remedies that might be going on at the site or other chemical or source areas. So if you have a combined remedy for a site, for example, if you're doing in situ chemical oxidation for your source area and in situ chemical reduction in a plume area, then you really need to make sure that your target treatment zone for each remedy considers the downgradient transport of that in situ chemical oxidation into your in situ chemical reduction treatment zone. Another thing to take into consideration is uncontrolled amendment discharge. So if you have a site where you're trying to do some remediation and there's a concern of discharging of your amendment to surface water, then that really does need to be taken into consideration when you're setting what your target treatment zone might be. And then, of course, as Rich has gone through, for all in situ remedies, obviously the geology, the hydrogeology, and the geochemical characteristics of your site are key. And must be factored in when you're setting your treatment zone. So there's different design support elements that we can use to help us in our design. These are extensions of the conceptual site model and the remedial design characterization data that we've collected previously. So the number one source of failure for amendment injection and remedies using amendment injection is a lack of an adequately detailed characterization of your target treatment zone, and then a reliance that, therefore, on an overly simplified conceptual site model. So we need to use some of these support elements to help us refine our design. Some of those tools that we can use are things like modeling and analytical tools, laboratory bench testing, and field pilot tests. And we're going to touch on all of these in this section of the presentation. So in order to help us walk through section 3 of the report, we've prepared a simplified case study. So this is an artificial site that we're just using to try and get some of these ideas across. So at this site, we've already gone through the characterization phase. We've identified where the mass is, what the geology is, what the hydrogeology is. So this is a site where there was a solvent release. We know we have source areas as well as plumes. We have a sand and a silt that's overlying a clay. We have contamination shown as this is the contamination, our source and our plume. They're present both in that underlying clay as well as in the overlying sands and silts. So in our case study, we are ready now to go to the design and remediation planning stages. And we're going to use some modeling and analytical tools to help come up with what we might want to test at this site or what technologies we might want to apply. And based on what we've looked at for this artificial site we've created, we're going to carry forward for consideration in situ chemical oxidation and enhanced in situ bioremediation. Those are the two technologies we're going to be considering for this site. So modeling and analytical tools are one of the design support elements that we can use. These can include things like parameter estimation, groundwater flow and transport models, geochemical reactions and geochemical models. They can range from simple spreadsheet calculations to complex 3D models. I think it's important to note that the complexity of a model doesn't necessarily guarantee its outcome, and that some of the, you know, depending on the complexity of the site you're dealing with and the amount of information you may have on that site, you can get some very useful information from simple spreadsheet calculations. Although, you know, obviously complex 3D models are also very powerful tools if applied correctly. There are some software that is available in the public domain and others that are commercially available and require a license. And table 3.1 of the guidance document is actually a listing of some of that publicly available software with links to where that software can be found and some of the applications for those tools. So laboratory bench testing is another tool that we can use to help with our design. It's very useful for determining the type and dose of amendments you might want to consider, especially in situations where your chemistry might be very complex or you're maybe looking at multiple treatment steps at a site. It can provide data to support the remediation technology or series of technologies that you're considering, and it often can provide that information in a very relatively fast turnaround time compared to field applications to give you some information on the degradation or transformation of contaminants that might be present at your site. However, it's very important to note that bench tests are conducted usually under ideal temperature conditions and under ideal mixing conditions, and that's definitely going to affect the results of your amendment requirements, and it's not taking into consideration and the heterogeneities that might exist in the field, things that are going to influence your amendment transport or some of the reaction kinetics you might be seeing. In the graphic on the or image on the bottom right there, we have microcosm studies, and you know, these are a situation where you have perfect interaction between your amendment and the media you're trying to treat. These are shaken, and so it's going to give you very important information, but it's information that you need to understand how it was collected so that you can properly scale it up. The figure or graphic at the top there is a column studies. These give you maybe a bit more of an idea of what it might be like in the field with transport, but you know, a column, even if it's collected from a core built from a core directly collected at your site, generally cores are collected vertically, and usually groundwater is flowing at least mostly horizontally, so you're not really giving an accurate picture of what the heterogeneity might be in the field. One of the key things to consider when you're doing bench scale testing is you should, if at all possible, be using site soil and groundwater so that you're getting the best picture you can for the site-specific chemistry. So these are generally not accurate models of the field because of the scale-up issues, but they are very good initial screening level evaluations of potential outcomes and effects of treatment, and they can be used to inform and initially optimize some of your field remedial designs for your pilot test or your full scale. Something that also needs to be taken into consideration in your design is secondary effects. So these can secondary effects can occur over a wide range of time. You can get transient shifts that last maybe hours or days, things like pH shifts or increases in groundwater elevations during your injections, or long-term changes that can last for years, things like redox changes, depending on what it is that you're injecting. So we need to consider those potential effects on during the design. And either evaluate and potentially mitigate some of those secondary effects if we can. And some of that can be done with these bench tests that we were just talking about, and also with the field pilot test, and give you an idea of what some of those secondary effects might be. There's an example there. If you add sodium persulfate to a site that has natural or anthropogenic chromium present in the soil, you can actually oxidize that to hexavalent chromium, which is definitely something you would want to be aware of and mitigating for. So I have a poll question, Nicole, if you can bring that up. We're just trying to find out if people have used bench tests in their design for their remedies. And if they have, people have used bench tests, have you used the outcomes from that bench test to change your approach for your remedy? Give people a bit of time to answer here. And it looks like a lot of people have done bench tests, which is great, and maybe more importantly, that they have used the results from that, or that the results from that have changed their approach to their design. So Nicole, if you can close the poll. Thank you. So we're back to our case study here. So we did ISCO or in situ chemical oxidation and in situ enhanced bioremediation bench tests for this site. And what we found out is that with the ISCO, in general, the degradation was faster. However, we did see more secondary effects, and we had a higher oxidant demand than maybe ideal for application at this site. Whereas the bio, we saw slower degradation, longer time frames, but there were fewer secondary effects, they were easier to mitigate. And so it was cheaper longer term. And for our case study, we were testing emulsified vegetable oil, or EVO, as the electron donor. And this is the option that was chosen to take forward for this case study that we're working on. So we've finished our bench test, and at this case study, we're now going to go out and do pilot tests. So talk a little bit about pilot tests. These are small-scale preliminary field events, and they're performed at the site under site-specific in situ conditions. And I think it's important to note that these pilot tests can vary greatly in scale. A pilot test can literally be going out to a site with a drill rig where you're going to do a direct push and injection and inject potable water to get a sense of what kind of pressures are you seeing. What kind of volumes can you inject over what time frames? They can also be, you know, very involved, years-long tests where have a much larger infrastructure. It depends on the scale of the remedy that you're designing, and you can scale these pilot tests to reflect that. The pilot test allows you to evaluate the impacts of the heterogeneity on the performance of your technology. You can look at time frames under real-world conditions, look at the effects of dilution, advective flow, diffusion, some of the adverse chemical reactions that you might get because of the chemistry of the matrix itself. It can allow you look at your amendment distribution, what kind of radius of influences you can get out of your injection points. Look at rates and pressure and what you need to get the desired volume in the ground. Like I mentioned before, with the bench scale test, the same thing with the pilot test, it does allow you to evaluate the secondary effects that might occur, things like metal mobilization or acid production. And this is actually letting you evaluate these at the site under real world situation. One of the other things that pilot tests can do, you're doing your pilot test and you're monitoring that pilot test, and that data can really help to inform the locations for sampling and performance evaluation. So what is your monitoring network going to look like for your full-scale performance? So these tests are used to test the assumption and incorporate that information into your full-scale design. So geologic heterogeneities obviously affect delivery are pretty key to understanding where your amendment is going to go in the subsurface. In general, your higher permeability zones are going to take preferentially more of your amendment. So we've set up just some graphics here to sort of try and show that. In the depictions that we have, the earth tones are trying to show the various geologic layers. So the darker the brown is, the lower the permeability is. So these layers here, for instance, are really low permeability. This is lower, and then the paler, the beige colors are assumed to be higher permeability. The warm tones or the oranges and yellows are contamination. So the highest concentration of contaminants are shown in orange, and then again progressing to the yellow, so less contaminated. And then our amendment is purple, and it's shown where we've got these arrows to show that we're injecting our amendment. As you can see on the graphic on the left, where we have a lower geologic heterogeneity, we're getting generally a more even distribution of our amendment out of our injection points. Whereas if you look at the case, the image on the right, where we have a greater geologic heterogeneity, you're going to get more fingering or more variability with depth and because of that heterogeneity. So understanding the distribution of your amendment, you need to take that obviously into consideration. The permeability of the formation is pretty key. The high permeability zones are going to take generally more of the fluids and allow a broader radial delivery, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's where all your contaminant is. It can also be in those lower permeability zones, and in fact it may mainly be in those lower permeability zones, so you've got to be aware that, you know, you've got to get the amendment in contact with the contaminant. And another thing to keep in mind is that those low permeability zones can contribute to back diffusion as the contaminant mass comes out over time, and it contributes to plume longevity. And then the other big thing that controls your distribution is the nature of the amendment itself. Is it a soluble donor like ethanol? Is it semi-soluble like an emulsified vegetable oil? Or is it insoluble like a ZVI particle or activated carbon? So another part of this delivery strategy is the pressures that you're going to inject at. So if you are injecting something like zero valent iron or activated carbon, generally those particles are larger than the pore throats that are available for fluid to move through the subsurface. So you're not generally going to be able to just gravity flow these or inject these easily out of a well. You're going to have to use something that's more aggressive, a high pressure emplacement technology like hydraulic or pneumatic injection, which is actually going to deform the matrix and either potentially form fractures or some way of getting that soluble amendment distributed out from your injection point. Sorry, solid injection, not soluble. Your soluble amendments, you can inject at different pressures depending on your design and how many points you want and what kind of subsurface you're injecting into, but generally soluble amendments can go under just gravity or really low flow injection as well as very high pressure methods. So this is table 3.4 from the document. And it looks at some of these delivery strategies. So across the top of the table are delivery techniques and things like direct push injection or injection through wells, EK or electrokinetics as a delivery method. And each one of these column headings across the top have a fact sheet that has a link in there. So if you were on this table in the document and you clicked on D1, it would take you to the fact sheet for direct push information. And each fact sheet includes information like the type of equipment you might use, the advantages and limitations of the delivery technique itself. So that is what is happening across the top of the document. On the far left-hand column is the hydrogeologic characteristics of your site, for instance. So if you were going to look at this table and you were going to go and, I don't know, pick a site that has a competent or fractured bedrock, then you can, you know, click on that row and look at the various cells, and each cell gives you an indication of the general feasibility of the various delivery technologies, and we've sort of characterized those as widely used, site-specific applications may apply, or it's just generally not an applicable technology for that hydrogeologic characterization or characteristic. So back to our case study. We are going to the field now to do our pilot test. We have installed some monitoring wells, performance monitoring wells here, and just a plug for, you know, you're always out, whenever you're out there, you're always collecting data, always feeding that data back into your understanding of your site, your conceptual site model, and your design. So if you've installed some wells, why not log them, make sure that that data isn't changing your conceptual site model, you know, feeding into information for your design. So for the sand layer, we, you know, installed our wells. We did our injection tests and our pilot tests, and what we saw is that we have a good radius of influence at low pressures, and we're getting very good distribution, and our monitoring is indicating that we are seeing degradation ongoing. However, in our clay layer, what we're seeing is that we have to inject at very high pressures, and that there's evidence that there's short-circuiting out of that clay and up into that overlying sand layer, which isn't our target for that injection interval, so that we end up with very poor distribution and an uneven or very small radius of influence for our clay layer. So that's the information we got from our pilot test. We have another poll question, if you can call that, pull that up for me, Nicole. Similar to the bench test, how many people have used pilot tests when you're designing your in-situ remedy? And again, if you have used pilot tests, have the results of that pilot test changed your design? And early data would appear to indicate that many people do use pilot tests, that often that pilot, that information is fed into, you know, back into their design and has potentially changed the results. And I'm assuming for the people who the results didn't change, you had a very good understanding of your site and a well-designed pilot test that supported the information you needed for your full scale. So that's good. If you can take down that poll question. So if we go back to our case study, we're ready now for full scale in that sand layer. We have the information we have collected to date and our pilot test, and we're doing a direct injection of emulsified vegetable oil in our sand layer. And, you know, we've got good distribution throughout our sand layer, and we've started to monitor our performance in our down gradient monitoring points, and our full scale implementation is underway. However, for that clay layer, we didn't have very good success in our pilot test, so we are considering now what should we do for that clay layer. And one thing that we're considering is going to use electrokinetic or EK to distribute the electron donor, so EK bio as an approach for that clay layer, but we have not got very much information, site-specific information for that, so we're going to go back to the bench scale test for that. And EK, there's a fact sheet on this in the document, but EK is a remediation approach that uses low-level direct current DC power to distribute your amendments in low permeability matrices. So we've taken some clay from our site and some groundwater, and we've set up a bench test. And we have an anode and a cathode cell, and we're looking at how we can use that direct current to distribute our lactate throughout our treatment zone. So with the lower K permeability, we've switched to using lactate also as a something that the EK itself can distribute. Lactate is an easier amendment for EK to distribute. So our initial lab data, our bench data results do indicate that we are able to use EK to distribute lactate in a reasonable time frame throughout our clay. So the next step is to go back to pilot test with our EK now. And we're doing an in-situ test. It's a very small scale test, a dipole test, where we really only have one set of electrode wells, and we're monitoring. And so if we had here a cathode well and an anode well, and we're using the direct current to distribute our lactate throughout our low permeability zone and getting that throughout the contaminated zone. So we had a successful pilot. We were, you know, our monitoring from that indicated that we did get good distribution. So we've gone to full scale with EK Bio, excuse me. And there's a fact sheet that, again, that explains in more detail what the EK is, but we've set, in, you know, installed a series of anode and cathode wells, and we're running direct current to distribute our amendment there. And then we've got monitoring points in between our supply wells for our amendment. And then again, in cross-section, we've got our supply wells and our electrode wells, the anode and cathode wells. So to date, we've been looking at these things in cross-section, but, excuse me, another thing that you need to take into consideration in your design is refining the number and spacing of your injection points. And there's, you know, different ways of setting these up in the field. And we're just showing some here. You can have a grid pattern where this is probably the most broadly applicable. There's very few site-specific constraints to using this type of injection pattern, but it is obviously giving you the most points that you need to inject, so potentially a larger cost associated with that. One thing to consider when you are doing something like a grid pattern is that you may want to start from the outside and work towards the center, so you minimize the risk of mobilizing some of your plume outside of your treatment zone. The next one here, and the next graphic down, is the injection and drift. In this case, you're using less injection points, and you're taking advantage of the natural groundwater flow to help distribute your amendment. This is generally more applicable in areas where you have relatively high groundwater velocities, and also where your amendment itself is relatively persistent in the subsurface. So if you have a very short-lived amendment, it may not actually it may not persist long enough to drift down, and you'll end up with some gaps in your target treatment zone. Recirculation is another approach where you are concurrently injecting your amendment in one well and extracting groundwater from another well. And this can really help increase the lateral extent of the amendments. And it also can help reduce some of the risks of daylighting, because you're really controlling the volume of fluid in the subsurface. And you can be trying to balance the volume you're injecting with the volume you're extracting. And that situation where we talked about setting your target treatment zone, if you are near a surface water body, for instance, and there's concerns with daylighting or having that amendment discharge to surface water, then you could be maybe using something like this to really help control where your amendment is going. And then the last one on there is a barrier where you have a line of wells, and it's a barrier to contaminants. You're actually allowing the groundwater to flow through that zone, and ideally it's getting treated. Another thing to consider is the persistence of the amendment also as well once it's injected. So we have some very simple graphics here. The circle is your very simplified radius of influence of your amendment. We have amendment at the initial injection, then the second circle is assuming 30 days after injection and 60 days after injection. In the situation where you have a very low groundwater velocity, you're not going to necessarily get very much downgradient drift with your amendment over time, versus, say, the high velocity situation here, where, you know, from injection to day 60, you may get greater spread of your amendment. And then the other thing we're looking at is high persistence and low persistence, where the saturation of color indicates how much of your amendment is left. So the darker the purple is a lot of amendment still present in the ground, versus the lighter ones where you're getting less and less. And obviously, with a highly persistent donor, something like emulsified vegetable oil, where it has to be broken down before the bacteria can use it as an electron donor, you're going to get a higher persistence. And at day 60, we'll have more of that left in the subsurface than, say, ethanol, where actually by day 60, you're probably not going to have any of it left because the bacteria can use it immediately. And so it's a lower persistence amendment. This arrow out of the way. So just to wrap up, remedial design is iterative. All portions of this document, I think that's one of the big messages we're trying to drive home. You need to constantly evaluate the data you have and use that data to feed back into the refinements of the document. You need to, if you're doing tests, bench tests, pilot tests, other tests along the way, use that data to refine the next steps. It's an iterative approach, and the constant evaluation of the new data is going to provide you a strong design and a more successful remedial effort. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Elizabeth to talk about performance monitoring.
Thank you, Suzanne. So I'm going to discuss the Section 4, which is the implementation monitoring and interpretation of the data. So Section 4 goes through and sets up the variety of different types of monitoring that a site might require. We've already talked a little bit about site characterization, remedial design characterization. We also have baseline monitoring. You may be able to use some of your remedial design characterization as your baseline monitoring data, but if something major has occurred at the site since that was done, you might want to perform it again. Some of those things might include a pilot study in the field, a major natural disaster like a flood or an earthquake. Some of those things can really shake up your system, and I would suggest starting over with some new baseline monitoring. There's also compliance monitoring, and this is what your regulator might be interested in looking at, and they may only require you to sample for that once a year. I would suggest if you are in active remediation, you'd certainly want to monitor much more frequently than that. So there may be a set of data that you do for the regulatory compliance perspective. But you also need to think about the process monitoring. During the injections, if you're doing multiple injection processes, either throughout your strategy, or the field parameters, I always recommend people do those field parameters. They're cheap, they're easy to collect as frequently as possible, even every 2 weeks, just so you have a track of what your pH changes are. And of course, all of this is going to depend on what type of injection strategy you have. If you're doing a bioremediation versus an ISCO, those programs are going to look very different. So Section 4 has some tables. It has some recommendations on what type of analytical parameters you might want to run depending on what your strategy is and the frequency of those. And if you'll take a look at this graph of the example of the network, there are also wells that you might want to place them, say, 30 days down gradient of your radius of influence from your injection. But those wells you would treat differently from a perspective of your monitoring program than you would, say, your compliance wells or your sentinel wells even. So what we're really going to talk about here in the coming slides is how do we determine if our remedy is underperforming, and how can we use our data to explain to us and suggest some optimization strategies as we move forward. And as we've talked about before, we have the design wheel. We're constantly going back and looking at pilot studies. All of this doesn't have to be done up front. And the example I'm going to walk you through, you'll see we actually do go back and run another pilot study based on what our information is telling us in the field. So hold on, and I'm going to run you through a case study because I think that's the easiest way. This particular case study happens to be an anaerobic bioremediation project. There are other cases in the guidance document that talk through some other remedies, but we're going to do this one on anaerobic bio. And this particular site, the total site is about 380 acres. It's a 12-acre plume, and that includes some off-site impacts. It's a pretty complicated geological setting. We have contamination in the saprolite, in the partially weathered rock zone, and in the bedrock as well. The contaminants are carbon TET, TCE, and, of course, their daughter products. And this site was a pump and treat system that had been running for about 13 years. The plume size had not really changed much. If anything, it had elongated the plume and spread it out a little bit more. But the source area concentrations were still around 4 parts per million, and the off-site concentrations were in the hundreds of micrograms per liter. So what we started with was this anaerobic in situ bio. We evaluated our data. We started by collecting our VOC data and field parameters on a monthly basis, and the key here is that we looked at them on a monthly basis as soon as the data came in. We didn't wait for a semi-annual or annual report to compile all that data. As soon as it came into the field, we took a look at it and had a plan. And we're always, we knew when to anticipate certain changes. We knew when we should be seeing the TOC change, our total organic carbon. We knew when we should be looking out for changes in ORP and DO. And when we didn't meet those milestones, we reacted. We had those contingency plans kind of in the back of our head on what we would do if we did not see what we expected to see. And in the end, we ended up incorporating hydraulic fracturing to improve the distribution of this site. So we start with a target treatment zone of about 4 acres, and we installed 134 injection wells on 25-foot centers in a grid pattern. This is a site that was ripe for redevelopment, and we wanted to get in and out as quickly as possible. And so we chose the grid pattern to get the maximum coverage. We installed those wells to the top of bedrock. We used this as an opportunity to continue our remedial design characterization and mapped the top of bedrock, and we found that we had a bedrock trough, and the highest concentrations of VOCs tended to coincide with the deeper parts of that trough. So that was a very key thing that we continued to learn as we were installing our remedy. This was an automated injection system so that we could operate our injection wells continuously or have flexibility and basically cut down on our field personnel that had to be out there. So here it is in plan view. So we have a source area right up in this area. This is from laboratory waste. Again, these concentrations were about 4 ppm. We had an automated system where we injected our carbohydrate through these different, this is our injection header, and then we had our laterals going to each one of the individual injection wells. We ran this lateral, the main header runs along the bedrock trough, and this was an above ground system, and I just ran it across the bedrock trough so that I wouldn't forget where that was spatially. So our injection, our amendments come down this line, and then they branch out to each one of these wells, and it can inject into typically 4 wells at one time is the way it was set up. So what do we see in about 6 months? We have some really good news in the source area. So we see here that our carbon tetrachloride in this particular well started out at 2.5 milligrams per liter. We see a nice decline, and by 6 months, we're at our MCLs. We, at the same time, are seeing some of the daughter products of that, the chloroform increases and then decreases. Same thing with the other daughter products like methylene chloride, and we also see the methane production. And here, so we see this increase in daughter products. A couple of the other things that we noticed, we also see a slight drop in the pH after operating the system. We see increased methane. That means that methanogenesis is being achieved. And we're seeing ideal redox conditions for biodegradation. They're established in the source area, but not uniformly across the plume. And when we get to the distal end of the plume, we see that our concentrations, we still have quite a bit of are constituents of concern down here in the down gradient. Now remember, our source area is up here, it's 4 parts per million up here, and that now meets our MCLs. However, down here where the concentrations were less than 1 mg per liter, we're not seeing a whole lot going on. We aren't seeing them increase, so we know that we don't have any reason to believe that we are pushing things down gradient through the injection process. We're just seeing a stable concentration in this down gradient area. So if we look at the redox parameters and evaluate those, this tells an even bigger picture. This tells us that we have methanogenic conditions up here in the source area. That's exactly what we want. We're seeing our ORP is negative 200 electron volts. We're seeing DO, less than 0.5 milligrams per liter. We're seeing methane. We're seeing everything we want to see. But we're not seeing that down here. So let's just do a poll, just an interactive learning here. So Nicole, if you could bring it up. If you were to take a guess, what do you think is our biggest problem given the data I've just shared with you? Okay, looks like the majority is going to say all of the above, and number two choice is looks like delivery, and I think you're right on. Nicole, you can move that aside. So, what should we do at this point? So my recommendation is always to go back and revisit your remedial design characterization and your design wheel. And by doing that, a couple of things that we were thinking was probably occurring at this site. If you recall what the injection header looked like, let me see if I can just. So you've got this injection header. This is about 400 feet from the start to the stop. And if that line is 2 inches in diameter, it's holding about 70 gallons of reagent just in this one header. We're injecting at a rate of a 10% carbohydrate solution at 10 gallons per linear foot. So let's say you had a 10-foot screen, that's 100 gallons. So what we're thinking is that if you inject here, early on, a lot of these are being injected under pressure, whereas the reagent stays in the line. And by the time you get down to the down gradient parts, a lot of that reagent is staying in the line and you're under gravity feed as opposed to injecting under pressure. So that was one of the things that we were concerned about. And so to address that, we needed to increase the ROI in those down gradient wells. And we were able to do that by increasing the volume from 10 gallons per linear foot of well screen to 25 gallons per foot. And in addition to that, we added a clean water flush just to flush all of those amendments out of the line so they didn't stay in the line and ferment. We did see a small pH drop, so with the amendment change, we could have chosen to add some sort of amendment to adjust the pH of sodium bicarbonate or carbonate or one of a half a dozen types of amendments, which are all described in Section 4. But it was such a slight drop, and our alkalinity was actually fairly high that we decided that maybe just lowering the carbon load to 5% would manage that problem. And as it turned out, it did. We also changed our delivery frequency from almost continuous. It by the time it cycled through 134 wells, that took about 30 hours to do, so we would just start it over with well number one after we made it all the way through. So we actually turned off the injection wells in the area, the source area, the ones that met the MCL. We no longer ran injections there. So we reduced the frequency of injection to every 2 weeks. And so after 12 months of operating in that configuration, what we find, this part of the plume over here cleans up nicely, but we still have a little bit of a stubborn spot here. And concentrations here are now 200 to 300 micrograms per liter, and we still need to address, okay, we've increased our radius of influence. Why is this part not cleaning up as well as this part? And again, here we are. This is the bedrock trough right beneath this header here. So it's happening at the deepest point. So that gave us a little bit of a clue as to what might be going on. So we've got another poll to see, Nicole, if you would, what our audience thinks is the problem now. Yep, and delivery is what I was thinking the problem was. So we can move on to the next one. So what's going on is the heterogeneity, and as Suzanne described in some of the previous slides, so as the amendments are being injected, it's following that path of least resistance, and it's just not getting into certain areas right here that it needs to get into. So, you know, we went back, we looked at some of our boring logs, and, you know, that's just, you know, here's a lesson learned. On this particular site, we took detailed boring logs of all 134 injection wells as we installed them. This site has a companion site about 20 miles away, and we took a shortcut and decided not to put the field labor and a geologist behind every rig logging every hole. And we did not have those boring logs to go back to. And what did we end up doing? We ended up remobilizing into the field on that other site, drilling new holes to get the data that we should have gotten in the first place. So I know you think you're saving money by not taking, you know, by taking shortcuts, but they will often come back to bite you, and it costs you more to go back a second time. So learn from my, you know, from lessons here. Go ahead and get very detailed logs. So what we found from looking at our logs, we had these silt and clay lenses in that particular area. And that was causing like a secondary source area where the clay had all the COCs had absorbed onto the clay, and now they've reached a new equilibrium and it's back diffusing into our aquifer, and we need to address this. So at the time of this predates EK, but electron kinetics that Suzanne discussed could have been helpful here, but hydraulic fracturing was the newest thing out at the time we did this study, and I was dying to try it. So we decided to go back and do a pilot study. So here we are in our pathway here. We've been down here in the full-scale phase, and we are just not going to think twice about it. We go right back up to that pilot study and say, yeah, this is how we're going to optimize our project here. So the first step in the pilot study is we install, put our fracture in, and these fractures are, you know, millimeter thick sand lenses that are installed by injecting sand in a suspension with guar under high pressure. We had, and after we installed the fracture, we installed a series of piezometers so that we could inject into this fracture and wanted to see how high up this, you know, where does the water level go? And here's an automation of it. So it fills up those fractures, and we had data loggers in each of these wells. And it was able to show us, well, it didn't adjust, it didn't do anything to the water level here, so we know it doesn't extend that far. But what we did find was that the influence was observed anywhere from 3 to 4 feet above and below that fracture. So the next step in the pilot study was to install a series of fractures that are stacked, and they're at about 7 foot intervals. And then we installed, here's a plan view right here, and we put the piezometers in 20 feet and 40 feet. And we once again injected through this well to see if it had a 20-foot radius of influence or did it have a 40-foot radius of influence. We were able to see some of the anisotropy here, and that some of these data loggers showed that the radius of influence was under 40 feet and some greater than 40 feet. So we think we probably had an average of about 45-foot zone of influence. So the last step was to go ahead and install a series of 11 of these stacked fracture sets at 75-foot centers. And then we, while we were doing that, we were doing some rebound monitoring, M&A monitoring in some of the upgraded source area wells. We weren't letting our time waste while we were doing this. It took about 9 months to complete this fracture test pilot study. So while we were doing that, we found that there was no rebound up in the source area. So what we had done wasn't, it was real, and we weren't having any rebound whatsoever in those areas. We hooked those fractures back up. Here are these fractures right here, installed all 11 sets of them. Hooked those up to the injection system, and we injected once again. So just a quick recap, we injected these now once a month. After just two injection events, our total organic carbon concentrations were in optimal levels at our monitoring wells in that area. And within 6 months, we had evidence of reductive dechlorination. We were seeing the methanogenic conditions. Our redox was where we wanted it to be. And after 9 months, we were able to transition the site to M&A. So here are the redox conditions. You'll see they're returning to aerobic up here in the source area where we were not injecting, and now they're ideal down here. Again, evidenced by ORP being around negative 200 electron volts and the DO being low, below 0.5. So as we transition to M&A, one of the things that's really important to know is when to stop, and especially with something like reductive dechlorination and some of these biological remedies. Once the COC concentrations get below around 50 micrograms per liter or less, your microbial populations are going to start getting a little sleepy. They're not getting their food source. It's not an ideal condition for them. They start dying back. So if you want to continue with a remediation like this, once you drop below 50 micrograms per liter, you may actually, for the first time within your project, have to bioaugment. We did not bioaugment at all on this project. In fact, we had a pretty immediate evidence that reductive dechlorination was going to completion from the very beginning, so we never ran any type of microbial analysis. It just wasn't necessary. On that topic of microbial analysis, I would say if you do not have conditions that are conducive to your bacteria that you are planning to use, and you have hostile conditions in your geochemistry, don't expect the microbes to be there if it's a hostile environment. And don't inject microbes into a hostile environment and think that things are going to be, miraculously the right condition. You need to have those conditions correct first. So make sure your nutrients are there, your pH is right. I did a peer review study on a site the other day that the pH was 4.5 and they couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. Well, you preserve it to those pHs when you send it to a lab. So make sure your conditions are right. But when you get to M&A, at this particular site, we were able to negotiate that with our regulatory agency that 5 times the MCL was an appropriate level to start transitioning to monitored natural attenuation. That is between you and your state regulators and your client, your stakeholders, and a lot of other people, so it's individual to each site. Consider the cost-benefit of additional remediation. It may be that you have done a remedy that can only get you to a certain point, and changing remedies and strategies, you might want to start out thinking about a treatment train to begin with. We do this quite often with other technologies where we might start out with a pump and treat or multi-phase extraction and then go to an in-situ remediation for completion to get the site down to where it needs to be. So keep all of these ideas in your toolbox. And, last note is, what is the final use of the site? This particular site for the case study started out, it had some restrictions on it, and it could only be used for industrial development. And when it came time for a buyer to be interested in the site, the only one that was interested wanted to build apartments. So suddenly my client is looking at going from an industrial cleanup to a residential cleanup. So that caused a couple of changes in the way we did things, and that we went a little further beyond what they had originally intended to meet the MCL goal. So a couple other cool things about this site. Going back to the target treatment zone, recall we only treated 4 acres. So, but the plume was a 12-acre plume. So natural attenuation, it was already occurring once we cut off that source area. Natural attenuation was very effective with the remaining 8 acres down gradient, including the off-site plume into the residential neighborhood. The bedrock aquifer, this particular area had a downward vertical gradient. So some of those carbohydrates got down into the bedrock through that process, and also through natural attenuation, the bedrock aquifer was also remediated. We did very little work in the bedrock at this site beyond monitoring it. One more thing about this site in the brownfield redevelopment, since it was used for residential use, and those are more stringent criteria, our client agreed to do that, allow the developer to change the zoning of the property, but only if they put in some engineering controls and some vapor mitigation in the base of the property. And this is where your client will tell you what his risk tolerance is, and this is a very risk-averse client. And so we put in the vapor barriers just because they had been involved in some emerging contaminant at other sites, and we're afraid that 20 years from now we might find something that we didn't know existed and it come back to bite them. So I always recommend that if you're going to be redeveloping in a residential type situation, is to go ahead and consider those. They're typically not terribly expensive. So key concepts, just to kind of recap on the case study, we actually have 4 different cycles. I suggest you always have a plan A, plan B, plan C, and have those in the back of your mind and how you might work those. Pay attention to that data. For this site, monthly evaluation of that data was key to the success of this project. So just in general, when you get into Section 4 and you start reading the document, the case study covers the anaerobic biostimulation, but the document also covers aerobic biostimulation, chemical oxidation, chemical reduction, and even surfactant and co-flushing. There are a number of tables, and throughout the document, there are links to fact sheets on strategies that are related to each one of those. The tables tell you what monitoring parameters are appropriate for each of those types of strategies, and gives you little guidelines into how you might interpret the data and use that data, and which data are more important than other data. And for instance, you don't need to do a microbial analysis every single time you analyze. That's something you might want to do every 2 years, if at all. So just kind of pay attention and know your site and take what you need to from those fact sheets and tables. And know that your sample frequency is going to be very different for an ISCO site than it would be a slower moving bioremediation site. Contingency planning, again, always be thinking about that and have it in the back of your mind. So at this point, I'm going to pass it back over to Chris McCandless with the Virginia DEQ, and he is going to talk about regulatory and stakeholder considerations.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. And as you can tell, this you've got the meat. You've just gotten the meat of our in situ remediation presentation here. Now I'm going to finish off and give you the bottom piece of bread, if you will. So we as regulators need this document too, so we don't fall into the old ways of the linear thinking. And that's another benefit of presenting an optimization document via the web and ITRC, to expose the states to this iterative and interactive way of thinking and design. As you see from this graphic, EPA recognized the need for an adaptive management style for their Superfund projects. This figure, modified from that memo, clearly shows an iterative process similar to the key graphic of this document, with the double-headed arrows going back and forth. Even though remedial activities may occur in situ and underground or on private property, the activities are noticed by people living and working in the surrounding communities. They want to know how activity may affect their lives. Honest and upfront communication can go a long way to alleviate fear of the unknown. It may also reveal potential consequences that were not previously thought of. It's important to develop a media communication plan identifying a single point of contact, anticipate questions in advance, and develop fact sheet and a list of frequently asked questions. All answers should be clear and concise. So, as you can tell from the graphic and the toolbox and all the great examples that Rich and Suzanne and Elizabeth have been presenting here, we want you to use this document. We want you to use it like your toolbox. It provides a framework for optimization, includes a number of tools for your reference. For example, the table in Appendix B I told you to use as your table of contents to direct you to the various content that you need for your optimization. And then the table that Rich got into, table 2.2 for the CSM, to dive into the fact sheets, click on the hot links. We're excited to have produced such a useful tool that is web-based, accessible, and adaptive to new technologies and new contaminants. As I stated in my introduction, use this document for making predictable and optimized outcomes for in-situ remedies using sound science and engineering. Now, as soon as we end this webinar, I want you to go to the guidance document on the web, upload Appendix F checklist to begin using everything you've learned here for your site. Thank you again. And now it's time for our last Q&A session. Nicole?
Chris, thanks so much. And thanks, Elizabeth and Suzanne, for that part of the presentation. Okay, so let's do some reminders here. We've had an active Q&A pod throughout the presentation, so thank you, everybody. But for those of you that may have questions here at the end, the Q&A pod is in the bottom right corner of your screen. I am pulling up some poll questions for you all to complete for us as part of this training. And then I do want to remind you that the Clumen training page does remain active in case you'd like to access it later. It does contain the slides from today and the trainer bios and additional links and information that you may find helpful. We also want to hear from you. So as a reminder, the online feedback form is linked on this last slide, and it is in the related links feedback form. When you hit browse to, it will pull up the form. Filling it out certifies that you participated and will provide you that certificate of completion if you are interested in that. So let's move on to a couple of questions. Here we have, some regulators do not allow high pressure injections that would result in subsurface fractionation, claiming that it would mobilize the contaminant plume further out. What is your advice for an alternative approach that a regulator would be more comfortable with? Trainers, it's #6 to unmute. Sounds like someone's trying to unmute me. Yes, now I can.
Okay. I think, you know, it would depend on what it is that you're trying to do with a high pressure injection. If you're doing high pressure injection, you know, because of a tight formation or a large substrate, then you know, you're limited in what else you can do. If you're doing high pressure injection because you're trying to minimize the number of points, then one option is using lower pressures, obviously using more of them or injecting it at, you know, different intervals. Also, sometimes a pilot test or working with the regulators to show that you can control, you know, your amendment and the groundwater flow from a pilot test, you know, that can be done under their supervision, can also help sometimes to negotiate using that type of remedy. And, you know, if the concern is mobilizing source, then you could even do that pilot test outside in an area where you have similar geology but no contaminants, just to, you know, to demonstrate the technology itself.
Thank you. This question is about ESS, environmental sequence photography, and is there any guidance documents available on the subject?
So I'll answer that. I don't know that there's specifically a guidance document, certainly not one that's out by ITRC at this point in time, but ESS is something that is certainly gaining recognition within the community of remediation professionals. We just recently recommended it for a proposal that I worked on for a site where you know, it's large enough and you can start filling in the gaps using ESS in your data, but you need a pretty large site and you need a pretty good amount of information to go ahead and start doing that. So I think it's something you're going to start seeing a lot more of in the coming years.
Great, thanks. Another question here, how do you draft a contract that takes into consideration the changes that may occur?
So let me take that one. So if you are talking about, you know, a contract between a consultant and their client, it needs to be upfront that, you know, it is, you know, each project is unique. And I hope that, you know, at some point, you know, your client has been educated, recommend classes like this so they understand that there is no magic bullet and you're always updating your information. You know, I think the general public has learned a lot about models in the last couple of months, and that as you get more data, you update your model, and as you get more data for our remediation projects, there are changes that have to be made. So it's a communication front. You know, most of our contracts I know that I've been involved in, typically we try to avoid making promises, but some government contracts, of course, require, you know, you have to achieve certain milestones. So it can get tenuous, for sure, but just communication is key in having your client understand that and your regulator understand that there is no magic bullet and all projects should be optimized. We rarely get them first, right the first time, unless it's just a really small, common controlled problem in a sandbox. And I don't work in a lot of sandboxes.
Great. We have someone that has a site with similar hydrogeological conditions of the case study, the current pump and treat system, and looking to try in-situ bioremediation. Do we have more information on the case study available?
The case study was published a number of years ago, but I would say if that individual wants to contact me and just chat a little bit about the site, he's got my contact information, he or she, and I'll be glad to discuss their site with them, you know, specifically. But, you know, one thing I would always say about in situ bioremediation is that, you know, you want to make sure that your remedy is you're pushing your you're changing the environment just a little bit. You don't want to go to from an environment where things are very oxidizing and try to institute an anaerobic remedy. Just because you have chlorinated solvents and TCE doesn't mean you need to go pump carbohydrates into an aquifer that's very aerobic already. It has to make sense. You know, how far can you push your groundwater chemistry?
Great, thank you. Well, thank you everyone for your questions today, and thank you to the trainers for not only providing responses to all the questions, but also the great information and training slides. If you need further clarification on the answers, or you'd like to ask more questions, please feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. We can follow up with our trainers, or you're welcome to follow up with them directly. Their contact information is on the main CLUIN training page for this session. And as a reminder, ITRC archives all its training classes, so if you find that you have additional time or looking for additional training opportunities, please feel free to visit CLUIN and the archive trainings to see if there are other courses that might interest you. Once again, thank you so much to all of our trainers and our attendees today. This was a great presentation and offering, and we hope that you really found some value. A reminder to pull up the feedback form and provide your feedback to us and any of your comments. And special thanks to everybody for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Have a great day.